This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 173, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 160 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Richard Dolan about his book, A History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects, Volume 1, From the Beginning to 1969. Richard Dolan is a leading researcher, historian, and writer on the subject of UFOs. He is the author of two volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. He also co-authored a speculative book about the future called AD, After Disclosure. He is also the author of UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. Since 2012, Richard has hosted a weekly radio show, The Richard Dolan Show on KGRA Radio. He has featured on numerous television series and documentaries, including Ancient Aliens, Hangar One, The UFO Files, Close Encounters, and many others. He's also a frequent guest on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Hi, Richard. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Simon, it's always good to be here.
So we're going to talk about your new book, which is called A History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects, Volume 1. From the beginning to 1969. So how many volumes are you going to write?
There will be three. And I've got them all of the cases. I've researched this USO. This is underwater UFOs, for lack of a better phrase. I've been doing this for 3 years. I've pulled up about just under 700 cases total, going right through 2024. And they're already organized into volumes. The first volume has been published for the last month. And the second and third, I expect to have them out, you know, within the next few months this year, certainly all this year. Hopefully by summertime, they'll all be out. That is my plan.
Oh, that's great. That's really working hard there.
It's been a long journey. It's been a labor of love, I'll say that. But yes, I'm finding, it's funny, I was planning already by now to be well into organizing, writing the introduction, the chapter introductions to volume two. And that hasn't happened according to my schedule yet. But and I'm finding that just everything else is jumping on top of that. But I do expect to have the second volume out this spring, and then the third volume, I'm hoping this summer. Yeah.
Do you think that this phenomenon of USOs hasn't had enough attention? Is it something that's been around just as long as flight UFOs, so to speak, and it doesn't seem to be on the radar that much?
No, you're right. When I started researching USOs really seriously in 2022, it kind of started off almost as just a little pet project. I wasn't thinking of writing a book. I was doing some videos for my website. Over at Richard Dolan Members, I'll do different types of video presentations on all different subjects. And I did a couple of USO ones in that spring of 22. And I just became interested. It was a fun little rabbit hole to go down. And I thought, what are the sources that are actually out there on this? And where are they? And are they organized and all that? And I found they're really not. They were not organized. There's a couple of books that have been done, some of them quite good. But some of them are pretty old, and none of them were really comprehensive, at least in a way that I thought. So I went on a mission during 22 and 23 to find all of the sources that I could find. Online databases or old books, out-of-print magazines, you know, all of that. And it took some time. I went through thousands and thousands of potential cases and sifted out the ones that I thought were actually noteworthy and the ones that had enough information that I could work with. I'm sure there were many USO cases that I bypassed simply because the descriptions were too threadbare and I didn't really have much to go on. So I went on the cases that looked like you could breathe new life into them and describe them in a satisfactory way. And that's what it was. So I was really surprised. There was not... I think there's always been an interest that researchers have had for a long time in the fact that there's a water aspect to this phenomenon. It's inherently fascinating. I mean, you know, we have to just recognize that it's very an object that can do zigzags in the sky. That's fascinating. But an object that can emerge from the water that's got some extra sauce on there. So I thought, let's see what we've got and how much is there, how big a part of the overall phenomenon is this? Is it different from the aerial phenomenon? Are the craft different? Is there something special about them? And all of these types of things I tried to investigate as I was researching these cases.
Were you surprised by just how many cases there were?
Yes and no, yes. Well, the first thing I have to say is there were, of all of these cases, maybe not more than five, maybe 10, if I'm being generous, are, you know, reasonably well known to the research community. It's not many. Everyone's heard about the Shag Harbor case, a good case. We've all heard about the Nimitz encounter, the Tic Tac UFO, which I do think has a USO component to it. And there's a few others, lesser known, but somewhat. But most of these, honestly, they've been never even discussed in the research community, as far as I can tell, or very minimally so. Maybe that's a better way to put it. So they've been ignored and forgotten. And so that was fascinating and in many cases, mind-blowing. Some of those cases are just incredible. On the other hand, when you compare the water-based aspect of this to the aerial aspect of it, there's really no question. There's far, far more aerial cases that we have in the databases everywhere than we do with water. I've often heard it said from different people, like 50% of all the UFO sightings ever have something to do with water. Don't think that's true. In fact, it doesn't look like it's true at all to me, but that doesn't mean that there is not a significant component that USOs comprise. They are a significant, very distinctive and important subset of the overall phenomenon of UAP, as we now call them. And they do need to be understood as a whole. So that was always that's been my goal to do that. And that's something that has not been done before.
So there's reports of UFOs that are transmedium. They can fly and they can go underwater. So did you come across reports about how they get into the water? Because what I'm wondering is they seem to move so fast under the water. It's almost as though they're not touching it. They're getting it out of the way somehow. And maybe when they enter the water at high speed, there's not even a splash. They just go straight in. Did you come across anything like that?
Yes, indeed. There's a lot of those types of cases. There are cases where they do make a splash. There's all kinds of theories out there. There was a researcher named Carl Feint who passed away about 5 years ago, who did a lot of work on this. And in fact, his number one interest, I would say, was to understand scientifically the relationship of UFOs and water. And by the way, that didn't just include bodies of water. It included rain, fog. He was interested in anything having to do with these craft and moisture, you could say. But a lot of them did include USO cases. And he really talked a lot about the ionization or the probable ionization of these objects, helping to create a kind of insulating shield around them to protect against the atmosphere as well as the water, kind of like a cavitation around the craft within the water. And that, I mean, I'm not a scientist. I don't have technical skills in that, but it seems like he did good work and it seemed like a reasonable proposition. And I think other people do probably think that's true. What you find with the craft, and they are able frequently to enter or emerge from large bodies of water without any overt disturbance of the water, or at least very much. And when they're in the water, they can go very fast. It's true. Although I don't think as fast as when they're in the atmosphere. So there is a difference there. The water does seem to have some effect on them. But still, you're talking about underwater craft that are moving in the often hundreds of knots per hour. It's very fast. We do not have underwater craft that can do anything like that. You know, a fast nuclear-powered submarine is believed to top out in the range of, say, 40, maybe a tiny bit more than 40 knots. So when you've got something doing 200 knots, it's maneuvering, or 300 knots, and it's diving down into the deep, you know, Puerto Rico Trench, or which is like 5 miles deep. Now we're talking about some very incredible capabilities, and they have been noted to do this.
Do you know of any specific case that's perhaps a nuclear submarine and they've spotted something moving like that?
Yeah, we have some stories. I've incorporated them into any one of the three volumes that are out. Some are from the old Soviet Union, in fact, and a couple, not many, are from the United States Navy. I have many more U.S. Navy cases that are from surface vessels, many of those, and a very small handful from submarines. But we do have a few. Just surprisingly low. The Soviets actually had the most. They, back in the 70s and late 60s into the early 80s, we know they had a phenomenon they used to call the, I'm completely mispronouncing this, the Kavakari, which is the Russian word for croakers, because these things on sonar sounded like frogs croaking. Soviet submarine crews would notice, they would pick up this very strange sound. And initially, they thought, is this American technology? What are they doing? It was very mysterious, but these croaking objects would be noted, like sometimes circling around a Soviet submarine in the ocean, maneuvering with impossible speeds and all of this. And they concluded this was not in any way likely to be American. We don't have a whole lot about what they concluded about this, but it seems that they concluded it's not from here. That seems to be what they did. There's a good American story. It's kind of like an anecdote, but it came from the U.S. researcher Mark D'Antonio, who I know, and he's told this story a number of times about when he was a guest on a U.S. nuclear submarine. They were actually in operation. He was, I think because of his government job, he was allowed to go down there. And he talked about being in the operations area there, and they detected while he was there a fast mover, moving very fast, faster than anything that should be able to move. And he said, you know, I listened to this, and then he was very funny about it. He said, you know, I thought a little too highly of myself, and I spoke to the XO, the and said, sir, if there's anything I can do to help. And the XO said, Mr. D'Antonio, you're having a good time here? Yes, sir. Let's keep it that way. So, it does seem that the U.S. Navy encounters these as well. I can say offhand, I've spoken in my life with a number of U.S. Navy folks. They typically have, this is even long before I was doing USO research, they always had the most dramatic and fascinating accounts of these types of encounters of any of the military folks that I ever spoke to. So I think, you know, they're encountering this, and it's helpful to remember just how dramatic this has to be, especially if you're under the water. You know, you're the U.S. Navy, so you've got to worry about the Russian Navy. You both have nuclear submarines. You both have very awesome offensive capabilities, and this is always a concern. You're down in the ocean. You've got your sonar, but you're basically blind otherwise. It's pitch black down there. It's like going through a massive, you know, thick, dense cloud all the time. And so you're worried about running into, you're going to run into the Russians, but then you encounter these other things. They're down there too. So there's a lot of drama involved in this, and it's not surprising that there would be a lot of secrecy as well.
Did Mark D'Antonio, did he say the crew were like really amazed by this, or did he get more of the impression it's like, oh yeah, we've seen this before?
I'll have to listen to him again on this. I did a little write-up of it for one of my volumes. But no, I think he indicated that it was a thing they had to deal with. They brought it up to the XO. And he said, log it and dog it. So basically, put it in there, but we're not going to do anything else regarding that. And that was that. So I think you get the idea that this is something that they have encountered before.
And is the performance that's seen, where they go so fast underwater, is that something that was seen decades ago? So, I mean, it couldn't possibly be human tech, because maybe some people could argue now there may be a secret program. But if in the 1940s something's doing 300 knots underwater.
Yeah, they go back quite a way. I know there's some good ones from the early 1960s where these things are being tracked going incredibly fast. And then, you know, you go back earlier into the 50s and 40s, and there are some equally astonishing cases, not necessarily of objects underwater being tracked at incredible speeds. I think that probably did happen, trying to recall. But certainly transmedium cases from that period of time are just astonishing. I was just reviewing one case even yesterday from 1952 from a location known as Shemya Island. It's on the Aleutian Island chain. It's closer to Russia than to Alaska. It's way out there. It's utterly remote, utterly inhospitable. And we have, a very excellent account from a man who was a rigger on the island. He wasn't military. God knows how you'd want to go there. That is like the last tourist destination you could ever imagine. In January, especially. So he had the day off on this 4 mile long island, you know, 6 kilometers long. I don't think there were any nightclubs. So he had the day off, and he's outside and he sees this bat shaped object. He hears it first. He hears like a whirring noise. He looks up, and not too far above is this bat shaped object. It's got lights, had a dome that was glowing red. That'd be shocking. And he watches it descend and then hover at about 75 feet above him. In the wind, it's just totally silent and motionless. And then he watches it just dive into the water at an angle. And he gasped. And he stood there for the longest time waiting for it to come back out. And it never did. It was clearly a very controlled operation. Now you ask yourself, okay, what could that have been? Natural phenomena? Not if you read this man's account. And if you know, he wrote a private letter, gave his full name to the organization NICAP. In the 1960s, just to describe it. He wasn't looking for fame or anything like that. Doesn't seem like natural phenomena. And then you ask, classified technology? From where would you launch such a craft in 1952? There's no place. This is just one of many of these phenomenal, I have to say, phenomenal USO cases that you find even from those early years. To say nothing of some very compelling cases from the 19th century, of which there is a handful, but that handful is pretty darn good. Pretty darn good. I mean, we don't have a lot, but we have enough to make you think this does not seem explainable in any conventional way.
I suppose, like, the sightings that were written down and reported in the 19th century, they didn't have the vocabulary that we have now for UFOs and spacecraft or even aircraft. So how do they write it down?
What a great question. Well, what you find is, you know, when people of that era are encountering the unknown, you're right. They were not thinking aliens from Mars or from another place. They're not thinking along those lines. They're not thinking along powered aircraft or sea craft like that type. So there are a number of explanations. For example, there is a few cases where you get these glowing spherical objects emerging from the ocean. We got those today too. That is consistent. But they had several of them in the 1820s, 1840s, the later part of the 19th century. And there's always an attempt, when they are sought to be explained, there's an attempt at some kind of naturalistic explanation. You'd read explanations like meteors. Now, how in God's name is a meteor going to emerge from the ocean? And in some cases, emerge, go back down, emerge a second time, and return to the water. But it just shows, like, when you have intelligent people, but they are confronted with something that is so far outside anything they know how to explain, they were every bit as good at grasping at straws as we can be today.
We know about UFO reports where they made, like, Maelstrom, where they went over the nuclear missiles and they got shut down. Is there anything like that with nuclear submarines where their missiles were shut down?
Aircraft carriers, for sure, both U.S. and Russian, and other types of ships, destroyers and whatnot have had significant amounts of electromagnetic interference. In fact, this is one of the things that I tracked. After I put all of these cases together, I ended up, I went back over all of them again to extract various data points from each case so that I could trying to have a fresh look at the data that might have existed and to see if I could find patterns. And I did. And one of those was instances of electromagnetic interference. So this would be like compasses spinning wild, or electrical systems not functioning, or communications switched off, or sometimes the engine of the ship or the boat being shut down as well, like all of those things. So there's quite a few U.S. Navy and several Russian or Soviet Navy cases where major ships seem to have been incapacitated for an extended period of time. One which is in that first volume that I published was from the 1954 account of the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt aircraft carrier, nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, one of the major vessels of U.S. power projection during that period, for sure. Well, that vessel had quite a few UFO and USO encounters in its career, in its service history. One was alleged by a former officer of that ship from 1954, and he was anonymous, but he was very meticulous in his description. And he said, look, you know, we saw this large cigar-shaped object descend from above. Weapon systems were not engaged. Well, were not able to engage, he said. It then zoomed back up and then came back down. Again, two disc-shaped objects emerged from the water and merged or entered this large cigar-shaped object, which he said was maybe 300 feet long. 100 meters long, something like that. And then he said the cigar-shaped object, this whole thing took 15 minutes. And he actually gave a minute-by-minute account. It tilted downward and just entered the ocean. During that time, he said weapon systems were not operational. They were not functioning. So the presumption is that they tried to engage the weapon systems and they would not. There's a case that I'll have in the second volume from 1971, involving another aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy. It appears to have been just north of Puerto Rico and near the Caribbean area there. At 8 o'clock, July 2nd, 1971, the ship starts, the crew members start freaking out because they see this glowing orange object hovering directly over the ship. Now, I don't know if that one emerged from the water or entered the water. What we have is the one witness who we have his name, he's been very explicit about this. He said that he ran communications of the ship and that all the comms started spewing out gibberish. So nothing was working. And this went for over 20 minutes where no communications were able to reach the ship. He heard people screaming and he went outside to look and he saw this glowing orange, yellow, orange, red, orange sphere. One crew member actually shouted, "It's God, it's the end of the world." So they were not having a good time. The ship went to battle stations, general quarters. He had to go back to his location, and he was not able to see what happened to that. But he did say for the next 20 minutes, there were no communications. And he indicated, and I'm not sure how he knew this, but that weapon systems also were offline. So, and there's others. There's other cases like this. So these things can do the equivalent of shutting down nukes, like we've heard at Malmstrom from 1967. In their own way, they are able to interfere with the operations. And when I mentioned the statistical breakdown, I did so because I tracked electromagnetic interference instances. And from the early 1950s onward, when you start getting these cases in USOs, just under 10% of all of the cases involve some kind of EM interference, I think 9.5%. However, that number is doubled when you deal with military cases. So there seems to be, as far as I can tell, a potential behavioral difference. Like these operators of these craft seem to be able to know the difference between a military ship and a civilian vessel, because the EM interference is double when it's a military. And just for the record, there's one other category where I noticed a really significant switch with electromagnetic interference. And that is if in the few cases where someone would report missing time, and there's a couple of those, or sightings of apparent beings associated with the craft. So that's a very small percentage. It's like 6% of the total when I combine them. But in those instances, those people were four times more likely to report electromagnetic interference than the norm. So very interesting behavioral changes and adaptations that at least it appears these objects are able to do.
So those reports people have when they're in their cars and the car engine stops and all the lights go out, they can do that to boats as well. And it sounds like they would do it to civilian boats when they're doing abductions out at sea.
It does look like that. And there are cases where civilian boats, they're more likely to have their engines just shut off than like a large aircraft carrier. And there are such cases. And what's interesting about those, I track all of these little data points. So one is, what is the relationship of the object to water? Was it only below the water? Did it enter the water? Did it emerge from the water? Things like this. And what I found is that when there were cases of missing time or beings, they were more likely to see the object emerging from the water, and that's all that they remember. And that makes me think that it could be that the object did initially emerge from the water. You have missing time and then no memory of the object re-emerging into the water or taking off somewhere else. It's just, you know, it's a theory and I wonder, but it does seem to be that's potentially the case.
Are there hot spots around the world where, I don't know, it might indicate that they've got some kind of base under the water? Or is it more a thing is that there's just nobody in these other places, so we don't know if this is a hot spot or not?
Yeah. Your second phrasing, I think, is probably more right on. There are areas where there's a lot of activity or where a lot of activity has been recorded. I should say that. Puerto Rico, unquestionably, is, I would say, the leading concentrated areas. There's just so much activity there, especially just directly north and east and west of the island. A little bit south of it, but much more in those other areas. The coast of Florida, both sides, the Atlantic or the Gulf side, are both very active. The Catalina Island area off the U.S. coast, definitely. Certain areas in the Mediterranean have been, particularly by the Italian UFO and USO researchers there. They are very good at tracking a lot of cases out there. You've got a good number of instances off the coast of South America on the Atlantic side. You've got the Sea of like the Asian Seas, the Sea of Japan, the South China Sea, that whole general area. There's a fair amount going on there too. Are they hotspots? Again, I think your second question there is really the most on point. It's how do we really know? We're not in every part of the ocean. We're not regularly out like in the South Pacific at very much. So does that mean there's nothing there or we're just not out there to notice it? And I really wonder. I do suspect that there are bases. I even just looking at some of the behaviors, like in that case where I mentioned the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt, you had objects coming out of the ocean and then this big object going back down into the ocean right there. I mean, you have to ask, what is down there? In this case, we don't know exactly where that ship was, that the officer who reported it literally said, I have a family to worry about. I can't tell you who I am, and I'm not even going to tell you where we were. I tried tracing the potential route of that ship, but there's a lot of potential areas where it could have been. So it's hard to know.
Have you come across what you might call crash retrievals, that any navies tried to pick something up off the seafloor or somewhere?
It would be a logical thing to want to do that. And yes, there are a couple of allegations that this, in fact, is the case. I can maybe discuss some of that. But what I would say first is that any kind of retrieval off the ocean floor, so you have to ask where. Because the ocean has all different types of depths. You go into the middle of the Atlantic and Pacific, you're going down through, 15,000 feet to 5,000 meters. That's a lot. That's very deep. We can't get submarines down there. You know, it's way too much pressure. You can get a claw in some cases to go down there and take something off the floor, this type of thing. However, a good 10 to 15% of all of the world's oceans are on a kind of a shelf where it doesn't go as deep. If you look at the U.S. Eastern coastline, there's a massive Atlantic shelf spreading out there where, you know, the depth can be as little as 50 feet or it can be as much as a few hundred feet. Now, that's a different operation. You can, in many of those instances, send something down there to pick something off the floor. That's not impossible. In some cases, you can even get human divers down in some of those areas. And there have been allegations of attempted retrievals. I have never encountered a single instance in where the retrieval was definitely said to be successful. There was one story that I did write about for this first volume. It came to me from a former Navy man who spoke with another Navy guy. You get all of these Navy guys having conversations where it was alleged that there were attempts to outfit one of the U.S. nuclear submarines in the 60s with a hatch that would be able to retrieve smaller sized UFO craft that had come to grief in the oceans. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I've talked with a few people who were very skeptical of it, but I could see a logic to wanting to do it if you know, the size of the object is right, if you're able actually to get people down to help with this, to maybe facilitate as one of several parts of a larger team to do such retrievals. It's really tricky. You know, back in the late 70s, the Hughes Aircraft Corporation had something called the Glomar Explorer. It was a big claw, massive claw that could actually go down to the bottom of the deepest parts of the ocean and retrieve things. And they did retrieve a Soviet submarine in the late 70s with this method. So it's not impossible, but it's involved, it's difficult. So I don't know. I don't know how successful they really would have been over these years. I could imagine them wanting to at least try for there's a lot of areas where there's just ocean shelf where you really could feasibly be able to do it, practically speaking.
And do you ever come across cases where it seems like there's a military presence? Maybe they're doing some kind of maneuvers or something, and that draws the attention of the USOs and they come and check them out.
Yeah, it's my opinion that this is a very important part of the whole phenomenon. It's like a little secret dance going on between us and them. And there's no question that there's a very strong curiosity, monitoring, you could say, that these operators appear to be doing with us. And not just military, but let's say especially military. That's, you know, you look at the development of global human technology during the 20th century and where we were at the beginning and where we were at the end. And it's just eons apart. We only got our first operational submarine into the water in the year 1900. There were earlier attempts, but they weren't really very impressive compared with what we can do in the 20th century. So we were not really able to go into the water in any serious way until the 20th century. And you can imagine from their perspective what they're looking at. You know, first they got really nothing to worry about. We're down here. The humans can't watch us. We're doing our thing. And then suddenly you have World War I, sonar, submarines. They're like, oh, they're getting some eyes and ears down here. Well, not much to worry about. Then World War II. Suddenly we've militarized the entire oceans of the world. You've got massive aircraft carriers. You get nuclear submarines by mid-century that can stay under the water basically forever. And now suddenly it's becoming a significant presence. And then, you know, we set up in the 1950s and beyond underwater sonar detection arrays. It started off slowly at first, but it's quite comprehensive now. So there's all of these things that we have been doing that you would have to assume any observing presence and intelligence would be taking notice of. And on top of that, you've got the situation of the Cold War, where literally a nuclear war could erupt. To say nothing of today, we're still, you know, we've got a very tumultuous global situation. So they're watching these humans who love to fight. We love to peer over our fences at each other with mistrust and weapons pointed. yeah, I can imagine they're interested in all of that. And it's like, so what can these humans do now? What are their capabilities now? I think that's a very significant part of it. So, for example, there's a lot of these USO encounters that happen where there is a significant military presence, especially U.S. military. I mentioned Catalina Island off Southern California. Well, there's a huge, massive U.S. Navy presence there. There's a massive U.S. Navy presence in and around the Caribbean near Puerto Rico. So one question you would ask, as you inferred earlier, are these objects military technology? And, you know, you have to ask that. I don't think so. I think these are way, way too advanced. And so I'm left with the idea that they're checking out the militaries. They are investigating. They're interested in what these militaries are up to. That's what I currently believe.
Do you feel that the USO sightings increased dramatically, like the UFOs did after the first atom bombs were detonated?
They did. And I think that's all measurable and objective data. There was a presence of some sort prior to that, much more limited, much more low key. And I don't believe it's simply because we weren't noticing them as much. We didn't have, I'm speaking of USOs here, we did not have much of an oceanic footprint in the middle of the 19th century, say, compared with the middle of the 20th century. It's no comparison. We're just vastly more ships, better able to detect and all of that. Still, there was a lot of ocean traffic in the 19th century, and there were a couple of interesting accounts that were recorded, but very little. I mean, 95% of all the cases that I have collected were from the 1940s and later. Only 5% are from prior. So it's a very small amount. It's significant, but you can really see a massive uptick in quantity, both with aerial UFOs, UAPs, and with oceanic USOs.
And do we see the same kind of shapes as UFOs? Do you see triangles, cigar-shaped saucers?
Almost all identical shapes. So with USOs, the largest subgroup was disc-shaped, like flying saucer shape. And that's about, it was 25% of all the sightings. There are a number of the cases where the witness did not give a shape. Shockingly, I mean, you'd be surprised. Why wouldn't a witness do it? But they often didn't. They often would not give a shape. I know because I've looked. But discs were the largest, followed very closely by spherical, like whether glowing orb or not glowing spheres, but spherical. And also, those are the two big ones. And then, you know, there's a lot of them that were just noted as a light. Just a light. And, you know, you don't really know what that shape is. Cigars, though, were noted in about 10% of all the cases. There's a small number of triangular USOs, very small number, about 5% or so. So that's, you know, I wonder, I haven't done this study with aerial UAPs. Might be interesting to do to really see what are we looking at in terms of the breakdown there. But triangular USOs are fairly rare. And kind of interesting is that they're the only shape that when I look over their geographic distribution, they predominate in waters dominated by the United States or Canada. That is North American lakes or oceanic areas that are essentially, you know, the private province of the U.S. Navy, like the Caribbean, for example, things like that. You get triangular. So that's an interesting thing. And combined with the fact that nearly all of the reliable triangular reports start in the mid-70s or late-70s. That makes me wonder, like, who's making those and are they different from the other ones? And I've often wondered this about the triangular craft.
What about sizes? Because there have been reports, people saying they see a UFO the size of a football field or even larger. Are there really huge USOs?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. They, in fact, you know what I probably should have done? I broke the categories into three types of sizes. I should have made it four. So I made it small, medium, large, but I should have had humongous in there. So the small would be anything that a human being could not fit into, like, you know, something like the size of a soccer ball or a basketball. That would be small. And then medium would be anything that could be up to, say, 50 or 60 feet, you know, maybe up to 15, 20 meters in diameter, something that could fit a few people. And then anything larger than that, I just considered large. But there were, and there's a lot of those. That's the largest, biggest category, actually, was large. However, if I really were to redo this, I would have created a fourth category for anything like more than, you know, just gigantic size. Because there's a certain number of those, and they definitely do exist. And some of them are gargantuan. And we're talking several football fields in diameter, in some cases, under the water.
I wonder if they can do 300 knots.
I think they can go pretty fast. That's what it looks like. Yeah. Some of them are, I think, were reportedly very, very fast. So big, big and fast.
Are there any decent videos or pictures, photographs ever?
Couple. There's a few. I actually only included one photograph in this first book because it was so old. I didn't have to worry about any rights on it. And you don't know who it belonged to. But there aren't that many. The one that I included, by the way, is not even a good picture. It was from the early 60s, and it was the object supposedly came out of the water and was photographed in the air, and it's you can see this fuzzy something. You don't really know what it is. There's one photograph. I can't really include it because it's a copyrighted image, but it's from 1990, and it's from the Caribbean, and it was an underwater photograph that shows a glowing greenish glow under the water that the person who took the photograph said was a USO. It's kind of an interesting picture. It's not a great picture, but of course, underwater photography at any time is not the easiest thing to do. But no, there's really not a lot of good photographic evidence. There's some, recently Jeremy Corbell helped to release some of the video of the USS Omaha from 2019. Those are interesting. It's arguable, are they actual USOs? But, it's a Navy encounter out at sea. So, no, we're really short on photographic evidence.
So I think I've seen a video that was supposedly shot by the Coast Guard. Was it in Puerto Rico? And there was a small object going over town and then went out to sea.
Yes. In fact, there is also one recently that was the courtesy of George Knapp, and he has a Netflix show that in large part does deal with USOs. And it's I can't remember, this is off of the west coast of the U.S. Pretty interesting video. I talked with George about this not long ago, and you can see this light is being recorded very clearly, and it's entering the water, and you can see it under the water, and you can see the glow under the water after it submerges. It's quite interesting, and that's quite recent. The one you're referring to is the Aguadilla, Puerto Rico thermal cam image from 2013. Puerto Rico is like a big rectangle out in the ocean there, and in the northwest corner is Aguadilla. And in 2013, they have an airport there that they do a lot of monitoring of, like, for drug interdiction and things like this. So they'll have the area monitored visually in that way. But what they tracked was this object coming in. It was coming in at a very high speed. It did not look anything like an aircraft. It could not possibly have been a balloon or a Chinese lantern. I have heard this explanation. It strikes me as absurd. It's moving at a very rapid clip. And then you see it hitting the water and then going into the water and then coming out of the water. And at one point you see what certainly looks like it dividing into two objects. That's very interesting. And then the video runs out. So that's been studied in great detail. There's an organization called the Scientific Coalition of Ufology. I think they do very good work, and they did a 200 plus page long analysis of that. Suffice to say, they considered it an anomalous. Conceivably, I mean, I'm sure there are people who will say, well, the effect of it splitting isn't some kind of photographic artifact, not real. I don't know. I can't argue this, but it's a very interesting case. And recently there was a film done by a friend of mine, Darcy Weir, who went down to Puerto Rico with another gentleman, and they interviewed the man. I don't think did he take the video, or I think he was operating the cameras when that video was made. And they actually did a firsthand interview with this guy. And he confirmed, you know, this was a highly, highly unusual thing. So yeah, that area is, Aguadilla is quite active. In fact, I've collected a number of USO encounters from that area, not just from 2013, but from different periods of time.
Yeah, I've seen a video from the police on the south coast of England over a town called Brighton of an object that looked like a Coke can standing up, and it was nighttime, and they were using infrared, and they were switching back to normal sort of stuff, and it just floated over the town, went over the coast, and went out to sea, and the helicopter didn't follow it.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. The UK's got some very interesting cases of USO-related cases, for sure. I'm not remembering too many off the top of my head, unfortunately, but there's a decent amount of reporting on this from the United Kingdom that definitely are, you know, have to be considered as USOs. And some of those actually got quite a bit of publicity at the time. I mean, they get dismissed by the authorities and all of that, but there's activity going on over there just as everywhere else.
So you say in the book that prior to 1968, sightings were equally distributed between day and night, but then there was a dramatic change.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another fascinating thing. I would never have caught this had I not done this unwieldy, but ultimately helpful statistical analysis. I'd never put a spreadsheet together before in my life. This was my first one. And it's a very large spreadsheet, I will just say. So I try to put all the data points in there. One of those was, did this event occur in daylight or at night? I didn't try to break it down any more than that. It's often impossible to. You don't really know the exact time, especially when you're going back to something that's 50 years or more. People will just, they'll just tell you what they remember. But day versus night was easy enough to do. Most of the cases I have, I was able to tell was this in the daytime or at nighttime. So that was good. And I just would record that. And yes, what I noticed was that up until the end of 1967, I had 51% of all of the cases up to then occurred in daylight. So roughly 50-50, a slight edge toward daytime. And then after that, it's dramatic. It's 75%, 74% to be accurate, from that point to today, have occurred in under cover of darkness. And it becomes more extreme when you look at military versus civilian. The civilian encounters have always, back in the early period and now, are much more likely to occur during daylight. Military encounters, it's since 1967, since then onward, it's been just under 90% have occurred in darkness. It's really quite extraordinary. So, you know, I asked myself, and again, I would never have noticed this if I had just written all the cases out and not done a statistical breakdown. That would have completely gone past me. But it's there. And, you know, I have enough of a data sample, close to 700 cases, where I think it may not be comprehensive, but it's not bad. It's not a bad sample. So I wonder why this would be, and I can only speculate. But one thing you can say that by the late 1960s, you know, we humans were becoming far, far better at all types of detection, including satellites. By the late 60s, we were beginning to establish a pretty decent satellite observation around the globe. And, you know, all types of visual means on ships were improving all the time. So you could imagine, perhaps, that the operators of these craft might have been thinking, all right, we need to be a little more stealthy. so we'll come out at night, we'll shine a big bright light so they can't really see what we are, and we'll do it that way. And that's really what it has looked like. So, you know, what's actually going on there? Are they seeking to be more covert? And I have to think, yeah, it looks like that. By the way, the transition, I did notice, like, for different shapes of craft, the transitions did not all occur at the exact same time. So, like, I think for cigar-shaped craft, they started going to nighttime operations maybe as early as 1965, 66. Whereas I think it's the disc-shaped craft might have been, like, maybe by 1970, this type of thing. So the different shapes of crafts seem to go to predominant nighttime operations, not all exactly simultaneously. And that too is interesting. And that might speak to maybe they had different policies, for all we know.
It seems like it may have been a response to human technology getting better and better. Is there some kind of, I don't know what it would be, like a sonar net or something underwater that's constantly monitoring, which may have been looking for Soviet subs and Russian subs now, but that does, you know anything about that, picking up USOs?
Yes. Well, we have, the U.S. created a system in the 1950s called SOSUS. That's Sound Underwater Monitoring System. I can't remember. So that's a series of sonar arrays that were established over a period of many years. You know, it took really close to a decade to get this thing going in a good way. It's become quite sophisticated now. So the purpose, at least the stated purpose, was to watch for or to detect Soviet submarines. And it's not just to listen. You know, now we're at the point where we've got outstanding, you know, algorithms that can detect, you know, different acoustic signatures and identify them. And so they're quite sophisticated with this. So you know, we can only speculate here, but certainly while they're listening for Soviet subs or Russian subs, you have to wonder, what else have they picked up under the water? And I will assume that they're picking up all kinds of interesting signals down there. But the U.S. Navy doesn't like to talk, nor does the Royal Navy, nor do the Russians. They don't like to talk about these things. So we're left to guess in some cases.
Fantastic. Well, it's been great talking to you again. This book is History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects, Volume 1, from the beginning to 1969. And that's on Amazon, I suppose?
Yes. It's in three formats, soon to be four. The fourth will be the audiobook that's in process now. I'm not doing the reading on that. I can't. I'd love to, but I just cannot. So I have a very, very excellent audio reader, and he's making good progress. But it's available as an ebook, as a paperback, and as a hardcover. All of those editions are color illustrated. I had a really wonderful illustrator named Alan Levine. He did just very nice work. So there's that. And, you know, I try to make it helpful. There's maps for every single case that I put in myself. And I try to provide a good historical overview of each historical period that we're talking about, put it into context in terms of geopolitics, UFO research, you know, technology and so forth. And then there's a very extended statistical analysis that is in that first volume that covers all three volumes, actually, for people who are interested in all of that. It is quite interesting indeed.
Yeah. And so you've already said the next two will be out this year.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Yeah. I've noticed how emphatic I am in saying that. I'm saying that because they have to get out this year. The good thing is that all of the case writing is actually done. It's all done. I don't think I have to do any significant revision of those, but they need to be broken into chapters with introductions and, you know, create the index. I do all the publishing. So I do every little bit of minutia of these books. And it's just part of my own little mania here, but I'm glad that I do it, and they will be done. They will be done soon.
And have you got plans for another book, or are you going to take a rest now?
Yeah, you know, it would be nice. Load up on pina coladas and hit the beach for an extended period of time, and maybe that will happen. But no, after these are out, you know, I still have the never-ending UFOs in the National Security State series, and that's looking like it will be two more books, not just one. So I published two volumes of that history, And I'm still organizing. You know, I've got volumes 3 and 4 kind of laid out. And I suspect that I'll get those done after these are out. There's always books to write. That never stops. And I've people asking about different types of book projects they'd like to see me do. And, you know, I consider them all. So I'm 62 now. My health is still very good. Energy level is pretty good. I like my afternoon naps nowadays. But I try to pace myself, and I imagine that I'll be writing books as long as I'm able to. And I hope that's many, many more years.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast. It's been great.
Simon, you know, it's always a pleasure. I enjoy your podcast, and I enjoy being your guest. So thanks for having me.
And that was an interview with Richard Dolan about his book, A History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects, Volume 1, From the Beginning to 1969. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my new book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and you can get it on Amazon. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.